Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Well, I've completed our chart here with the correlative pairs that more or less summarize the content of the first lecture. Recalling that while many things can be referred to as nature, there is a convergence, more or less. All of these things have an intelligible order among themselves if we consider them with reference to form. So while, yes, matter can be, let's say, associated with nature, we can say a thing's nature and then describe its material composition, it's better referred to according to its form. Likewise, things accidents, more or less, but best according to substance. Remember that the definition of nature in its basic form in the physics is according to the principle, the intrinsic principle of motion and rest in a thing. And that makes us think then about act and potency, that even if a thing is not currently in act, its nature, let's say, is the principle according to which it can receive, receive a change, be at motion or in rest. Moving into the properly metaphysical domain, we can consider things in terms of essence and esse. Essence being the kind or definition, associated with a definition. It has a reality that's separate from the linguistic definition. So the definition puts its finger on the reality that it is in essence. Whereas esse, leaving it in the Latin here, which I think is the best route with this, refers to the act of being that is composite. With any created thing, essence and esse are distinct, are really distinct. So with the only uncreated thing, i.e. God, he is ipsum esse, he is his own act of being, he is being itself, as I'm sure you're familiar with Aquinas' doctrine on that. So I have arranged the pairs. I remember I may have suggested this, that you can shift around which of the correlative principles you put on the top and which you put on below. And what's useful about juxtaposing them all together is we can make associations, and Aquinas will often do this. We'll say this stands as a principle of actuality relative to this. This stands as a principle of form relative to this. What I have done in this arrangement is showed you, let's say, the top row are things that are perfective. So form makes a thing to be what it is. It is by means of its form, by way of form. So form is perfective of matter. Substance too. Accidents have to inhere in a substance. In a way, accidents can be said to perfect a substance, to make it more perfect in a particular aspect. But strictly speaking, we want to associate nature more so with form and with substance. Now, esse and essence, I want to get into this. So I focused in the first tack more on the basic Aristotelian heritage of the notion of nature, but now I want to focus on Aquinas' metaphysics of esse and what I've taken to be called the scale of esse, because his metaphysics of esse is fully integrated into a comprehensive scalar view of reality. And that's my phrase. Again, it may sound oblique, but there's reasons for it. So the structure, this talk is perhaps more clearly structured. I will give a brief prelude about some of Aquinas' sources for this scalar vision, and then I will introduce his metaphysics of esse, showing how it's integrated with this scalar vision. So that's part one and two. In the third part, I'll underscore the key role of being, life, and intellect as demarcating the fundamental, you might say the most fundamental divisions of reality. After the divide between God and creatures, what's the most fundamental divisions amongst creatures? Well, those that are mere beings, those that have being with self-motion, i.e. are living, and those that have intelligence. Lastly, I'll discuss some of the advantages that Aquinas' account has in preserving our own intuitions about nature. And show that it's something that enriches the Aristotelian close-up analysis of substance and form. We'll also see that with this scalar vision, we can have a greater flexibility in the notion of these principles of nature. So part one, a brief word about sources. Aquinas presents a synthesis of elements that's not reducible to any particular source. And much of this synthesizing, especially of Aristotle and Plato, was already well underway in late antiquity. So please permit me a brief word about some of these sources, not to present anything exhaustively, but simply to complexify the labels Aristotelian and Platonic. Thérèse Corey, in an article, says that these adjectives, these labels, are only as good as what we know about the things they connote. So they too, labels too, are received according to the mode of the receiver. And so we want to refine our notions so that we can receive, let's say, the accurate account more easily. Aristotle's works were made the necessary propedeutic reading in the late antique Platonic schools. And there's a free interchange and symbiosis of, let's say, Aristotle's logic, his biology, with the way, with the late Platonists, and the way they described even the higher supersensible realm. So this sort of work, this sort of synthetic work, is already begun inchoately in Plotinus, but is further schematized by Iamblichus, who really he marks a turning point in the history of Platonism towards a highly schematized account. In Plotinus, it's not really proper to speak about an exitus reditus scheme or an emanation scheme in a proper sense. It's only inchoately possessed. But things get schematized with Iamblichus and those figures that follow after him, like Cyrianus, who himself was the teacher of Proclus. And then coming at the very tail end of the project in Athens, we have Damascius. Now, perhaps sitting at the feet of Proclus, and perhaps a colleague to Damascius, was a certain zealous soul who would later compose the corpus of mystical and philosophical works under the pseudonym Dionysius the Areopagite. And his Divine Names, his work on the Divine Names, gives the definitive Christian reception and response, or critique, of Proclus's Platonic theology. Dionysius would influence the medieval West through various figures, but do so with renewed vigor in Albert and Aquinas's day. It's thought that Albert really made Aristotle and Dionysius the two central pillars of his studium in Cologne. And so when Aquinas is going through his formative years sitting at the feet of Albert the Great, these are some of the sources he's receiving most clearly. We also know that Platonism made a big hit in 9th century Baghdad with the Abbasid translation movement. So in the school of Al-Kindi, who was sort of the godfather, at least at a certain point, of the translation movement, not necessarily himself a translator, but one sort of directing this work. Al-Kindi, in his school, the works of Plotinus and Proclus that had been translated into Arabic were at play. And there were various pseudo-Aristotelian works that came out of this. The most influential one upon the medieval West was the Book of Causes, the Liber de Causis, which presents a robust metaphysics of creation with a scalar vision of the suprasensible realities. Alongside the Divine Names, the Liber de Causis exercised an important influence on Aquinas even early in his career. Later on in his career, after 1268, he had direct access to Proclus, and from that formed a much clearer vision of Platonism, I believe. And evidence shows up in his last works, such as the De Substanti Separatis, which I've already mentioned. So these are just some, but not all, of the influences on Aquinas's metaphysics of creation and the scalar vision he had. Mention should also be made of Avicenna and the important role he had for, let's say, assisting Aquinas in developing the essence-esse distinction as we know it. So more about that, Aquinas on the metaphysics of esse. The most fundamental division in reality is that between God and creatures. It's what Monsignor Sokolowski has dubbed the Christian distinction, and noting that there is that God does not stand as a part of the scale, so to speak, of reality, but stands transcendent to it as its creator. And so There's no distinction in God between his essence and his act of being, or esse. He is pure act and unlimited esse. And so he is ipsum esse, or being itself, ends per se, being through itself. And creatures falling underneath him, under that thick black line, so to speak, that we draw for the Christian distinction, falling underneath him is being by participation. All creatures have some composition of essence and esse. They participate God's perfect esse in a more limited and imperfect mode. Material creatures, as we've been exploring from the Aristotelian way of proceeding, material creatures have a further composition of matter and substantial form. And so while the purely Aristotelian vision, in the purely Aristotelian vision, essence is always associated with actuality and unitive energy, as I've described, we can also think of essence as imposing a kind of limit on esse. So pure esse is proper to God, but in creatures, esse is always composed with an essence, that is, a determinate species. Essence limits esse. Nonetheless, we should attend to the fact that being is an act. In fact, the most fundamental of acts. The act of being, or actus essendi, is the act of all acts and the perfection of all perfections, to quote Aquinas. So a creature is not just a static kind floating out there, but fundamentally, from the beginning of its existence, it is a composition of a kind and an act of being. Now, when we use our human language, of course, we invite analogy, we invite metaphor. So you might visualize esse as a kind of unlimited gas, as it were. I mean, if I didn't suggest this, you probably would have, you know, got there anyway. That can only be compressed into the limits of a container of a determinate size. So again, in philosophy, we come up with bad images, we tell you why they're bad. We tell you to stop thinking about it that way, but then we don't give you a good image because at a certain point we have to ascend beyond images as we know them in the material realm. So while this isn't an accurate image, it does help us. I mean, essences are not mere containers of esse. To think so would be to do a bit of Lego metaphysics where you put one correlative pair, you know, you juxtapose it with the other and say, here, I have a composite. No, these things never exist separate from one another. Essences are not mere containers of esse, but it can be a useful image, especially in seeing how essence limits esse. So we need to imagine, in this case, that the gas simply cannot or never exists outside of the container, nor can the container actually exist without gas in it. So see how we're purifying the image already a bit. They must come into being at the same time. So the essence and esse in any creature must come into being at the same time. They're also proportionate to one another. It would be a mistake to quantify esse and to say that essences are just amounts of esse. However, quantity helps us, a kind of analogy to quantity helps us understand how things can exist on a scale, and that's what I'm driving at. So the possession of diverse shares in esse by diverse creatures invites us to consider esse according to different intensities. And this is what Father Cornelio Fabro coined the doctrine of intensive esse that one finds in Dionysius, that he claims Aquinas found in Dionysius, the Pseudo-Areopagite. So composition of essence and esse, let's say, is a kind of participation. I'm going to avoid getting into participation in this talk, but simply to say that composition is logically prior to any subsequent relation that a creature has. Now, why am I saying it that way? Why is that important? Well, there are people out there, I warn you, you heard it here first, who will talk about creatures as pure relations to God, that fundamentally, before anything else, we are a relation to God. Somebody like Fabro is very, very fierce about warning us against that. Because a thing can't have a relation, i.e. an accident, prior to being composed in its proper substance. Now, this may seem like it doesn't matter because these things happen at the same time anyway, but thinking about the logical priority actually does matter. So composition of essence and esse is prior to situating a creature on any continuum. This is, by the way, if you've ever heard of Fabro and his disagreements with Father Geiger, a Dominican priest, they both had in the middle of the 20th century these grand works on participation in Aquinas. And I think, unfortunately, Father Geiger didn't really get an opportunity to completely respond to Fabro. And so I do think Fabro's account is closer to the truth, but he could have been a little nicer about it. I guess that's basically what I'm saying. He makes it sound like Geiger is leading you off into the worst of errors. I think it's a bit exaggerated, but I do think fundamentally he's right. And this is the essential disagreement, that composition, that type of participation, the horizontal composition of essence and esse, is primary to setting a creature in relation to God, and that there is a real sort of difference between these two notions. So, you know, I could talk about more of that later, but really I want to show you that's the metaphysics driving this scalar vision. It's what's behind. You know, if you were to, I don't know, I'm not a programmer, but I imagine it being like this. It's the code in the back, you know. It's what Aquinas shows us is a true integration of two visions. You know, the up-close, horizontal, Aristotelian perspective with the more Platonic scale. And that's his advantage, isn't so much doing one or the other or one more than the other. It's showing a kind of full integration of the two, like keeping either one from an extreme that's, let's say, contrary to the faith, or even more fundamentally, contrary to the truth and to good philosophy. So one of the keys to this whole vision, this scalar vision of Aquinas, is the notion of a metaphysical species, or a species understood by the metaphysician, as opposed to a mere logical notion. So for the logician, every species in a genus is an equal member of that genus. So all animals are of the genus animal. I have a long quote. You probably don't need it. You could just take my word for it. But Aquinas says this. If you want to challenge me on it, I have the quote at the ready. But the cash value is that for a metaphysician, difference always implies inequality. So even within a genus, species are arranged in a priority of greater or less. So the most succinct and explicit account of this, or attestation of this in Aquinas, can be found in the De Malo, in the response to an objection. The objector says something quite provocative. He says, well, mortal sin, venial sin, they're all sin, so they're all equal, right? And Aquinas responds, all animals are equally animal, but not all animals are equal. It may remind you of George Orwell's Animal Farm, you know, but what Aquinas doesn't say is some animals are more equal than others. No, despite the Orwellian ring, what he's saying that some animals have a higher essence, a higher dignity. And so he obviously puts man as the rational animal, as the highest in the genus of animal. So we see that a scale exists even among species. Now, it's not being asserted that within a species you have this same kind of scale. But among species in a genus, yes. So a properly metaphysical vision of this scalar vision is that beings are arranged not like steps in a typical staircase, where you have these jumps, and sort of, if we imagine that each step is a genus, rather, the steps themselves exist on a kind of gradient. This type of staircase actually is very common in Europe. Some of the outdoor, it's a scala cordonata in Italian. And so if you had a horse, for example, which stands pretty high, I think, on the genus of animals, you could climb the stairs with the horse because the steps are on a continuum like that. That's the vision, that's the image, to show you that species are arranged in an order of priority. Again, because Aquinas says that in a way, species of things are like numbers, and he's quoting the metaphysics here, because they're diversified by addition of one upon the other. So to the degree that something's more perfect, it's closer to the most perfect. So things are arranged in a scale, all nested under absolute perfection. So why is inequality important, and how does it lead to a big synthetic picture? Well, precisely because it gives us an an ability to account for both continuity and distinction. One of the problems amongst the later Platonists is they emphasize continuity so much that they actually struggle to tell you when one substance begins and the other ends. So this grand emanation continuum doesn't do such a good job accounting for the stable existing of a particular substance. So species are like numbers in differing by the addition of one upon the other. So this doesn't mean that essence is reducible to the category of quantity. It doesn't mean that essence is just an amount of esse. However, there is a scalar structure in which each genus is one greater than another in terms of its being. So a greater essence necessarily has a greater share in esse because they're proportioned one to another. So a merely Aristotelian vision on its own may struggle to give a comprehensive vision of the whole cosmos to show how something is ordered one against the other. The microscopic analysis is indispensable of substance, but it may leave some of the other domains of reality, for example, an account of the angels. It may leave that unspecified or underspecified. So this scalar vision emerging through some of these late Platonic influences helps bridge the gap. Now, what are the most fundamental divisions in this scalar structure? Well, I've said that after the Christian distinction between God and creatures, the most fundamental division is between merely existing things, living things, and intellectual things. So being, life, and intellect, a triad. You may have heard of this triad of being, life, and intellect, just generally speaking referred to as a Neoplatonic triad. I have a big picture for you on the other side of the board that I'm going to begin explaining. It's like a cooking show. There it was in the oven, ready to go. So this is to show you how Aquinas is able to acknowledge certain aspects of the Platonic scale on the one hand, however also to critique it, and to show that as it happens, well, his own account of the universe, which he takes flowing from Aristotle, from the Christian faith, from Dionysius, has some overlap with that account, but according to different principles. And so being, life, and intellect as a triad is a leitmotif in Aquinas as well as the Platonists, but it means something different in either account. It's functioning differently. Sometimes this triad is referred to as the noetic triad, from nous, from intellect, the word for intellect. In Proclus's system, it's a linchpin that holds everything together. And it's one of his contributions. We never know how much is new with him. Probably was already present in Iamblichus and others, but his are the texts we have where it's most clearly spelled out. Just by way of explanation, in Proclus's system, being, life, and intellect is a consequence of the triad of emanation, which is not merely exitus reditus, it's remaining procession and return. So remaining procession and return. So being is the mere remaining, life is the procession out, intellect is the return. That's just to show you that there's some deeper principles at work throughout his thought that this is connected into. And I'm not trying to explain that altogether, just to assert that if you've heard of emanation scheme, this is really where it's at work. More importantly, and this is something Aquinas understood after reading Proclus, the noetic triad explains why there are different lower tiers of reality for the Platonists, because this division of supersensible realities gives rise or influence on the lower. So you can see how if we take being, life, and intellect, and Aquinas is reading a Proclus, so this is a qualification, as being more or less members of the world of ideal forms, but organized in a certain way, then we can see how life itself, for example, governs the order of souls, things that are alive. The ideal intellect is sort of the one governing, as it were, the whole tier of intellects. So you don't need to appreciate the historical genesis of these ideas necessarily. I think it's always good to know more, but you don't need to appreciate this if you feel a bit lost. That's okay. But what's more important is how Aquinas makes use of it. He employs a triad of being, life, and intellect in different ways. First, we can see how he does this with essential perfections in God. So these perfections do not have a separate existence, the way the Platonists maintain, but rather God himself is being itself, is life itself, the life of all the living, in him we live and move and have our being, and intellect, pure thought, thinking itself. So these perfections have their fullness in God, and nor are they really distinct in the sense of, that's a technical term, really distinct in God. More than Aquinas, we should credit Dionysius for collapsing the subsistent perfections of the Platonic system into one highest principle. Now, technically, Dionysius maintains God is beyond being, but if we follow Aquinas' interpretation of Dionysius, we can kind of acknowledge that was a way of speaking that shows God is not participated being or ens communa. It's a way of distinguishing, making, emphasizing the Christian distinction effectively, that God transcends and stands apart from the grand continuum of participated creatures underneath him. So put simply, Aquinas identifies subsistent being, life, and intellect with God himself. And he does so compelled both by revelation, but also just by good philosophy. It's interesting. For example, if you read his commentary on the Liber de Causis, he's often working with the text, clarifying its errors, and then at the end he gives a kind of determinatio. And more often than not, you see Aristotle, Dionysius, and the Catholic faith almost speak with one voice on whatever issue it is, because they're offering a proper corrective to some of the more Platonic extremes. So despite the major correction of the Platonic system, he agrees with the Platonists in holding being, life, and intellect are the major divisions of the universe of creatures. They're the most fundamental categories into which we can corral the myriad of diverse essences or natures. It's important to note, too, that the principle this scale exists on here for the Platonists is according to universality. Again, this is Aquinas' analysis, so if someone, you know, the real scholars on Proclus would be upset with me if I gave you this. I'm telling you how Aquinas thinks of his Platonic sources. And this, he basically, the more common something is, the more possessed by more members, the higher it is in dignity. And so that's why the thing that's most fundamental, the one, which is also identified with the good itself, is possessed by the most things. And for the Platonists, it's even beyond being. Okay? And Aquinas even has his way sort of around that. What's important for him is that for the Platonists, there's a highest principle that's the cause of everything underneath. Right? There's actually not a mediated creation so much going on for him and the Platonists. That's a little bit more something that comes about with the Arabs, with Avicenna in particular. So that there's a highest principle that's responsible for all the rest of reality down to the level of prime matter. And by the way, let the record show, matter is not evil, unlike what some earlier Platonists thought. So that's a big difference between Proclus and, say, Plotinus. Okay, what's the principle by which the scale is arranged? Well, according to Essay. So Essay itself, but also greater participations in divine Essay. That's the principle, not universality, but Essay. So you can see how even if the scales have different principles and there's major differences, a lot of what they say about the arrangement of reality can be seen as congruent. And Aquinas acknowledges that. And that's why the Platonists end up saying a lot of true things about how higher realities transcend lower ones and also almost providentially care for them. So we'll get more into that. Aquinas doesn't merely adopt Platonic language on occasion, but integrates it. And it's this method of integration that I'm trying to stress. He's able to discuss being and life and intellect as structuring principles of the universe, but he also integrates it completely with an Aristotelian account of form. And one of my favorite texts, this very, very helpful text from the commentary on the Liber de Causis, where he's aware of the Platonic triad and its role in Proclus. After reading Proclus, Aquinas is aware of that. Yet he explains how that same general structure can be arrived at by considering diverse natures and forms from the ground up, so to speak, from more of an Aristotelian method of approaching. So I'll read you this from proposition 18 of his commentary on the De Causis. It must be considered that all grades of things seem to reduce to three: esse, vivere, et intellegere, being, life, and intellect, but put in the infinitive. So, and the same way, any given thing can be considered in a threefold way. First, as it is in itself, and thus how its own being befits it. Second, insofar as it tends to something else, and thus how it befits it to be moved by itself. And third, according to the other things that it has in itself, and thus it befits it to know, conoscere, since knowledge is perfected insofar as the known is in the knower, not materially, but formally. So just as having something in itself formally and not materially, so think of the way we know, constitutes the nature of knowledge, is the most noble mode of having or containing something, so too to be moved by oneself is the most noble mode of mobility, self-movement. And this constitutes the nature of life. For if we call that which can move itself in some way a living being, for we do call that which can move itself a living being. Therefore, being is first and common to all things, but not all things that have the perfection by which they be self-moving. Thus, not all things are living, but only those which are more perfect among beings. It's a long way of saying the perfections of being, life, and intellect serve as these fundamental ways form can be operative, right? So the having in itself, but without a further perfection of motion. The self-motion proper to living things, you might say, but plants don't move themselves. Well, they do, just very slowly. Or they propagate their form through seed is another way of thinking of it. And then, rightfully so, with intelligent creatures having the perfection of intellect also received from the Creator. So we can give our favorite examples of every form of life, beginning with mere beings. We name our favorite minerals, then our favorite plants and animals, ascending the scale. And what this scale, as a properly metaphysical scale, allows us is to give an account further for separate substances, for angels. So composed of essence and esse, not having matter, but in a way form, and each one being its own essence. So because of the title of the conference, I want to mention that this scale is also the way in which Aquinas organizes the appetites that show us the natural law. And so in the Prima Secunda, in question 94, article 2, a man has appetites linked to self-preservation, more or less maintaining his being, and growth and reproduction, education of offspring, the things proper to him as an animal, and then the goods of the mind and civil society. He says at the end of that quote, I'll just read you to the end. Thirdly, there's in man an inclination to good according to the nature of his reason, which nature is proper to him. Thus man has a natural inclination to know the truth about God and to live in society. And in this respect, whatever pertains to this inclination belongs to the natural law. For instance, to shun ignorance, to avoid offending those among whom one has to live. I'm kind of imagining that as a little jab at his Dominican brothers. You're not just bothering me, it's against the natural law to cough so much in choir, you know, or whatever it be, the natural friction of life and community. Okay, so what remains basically are two broad conclusions about the advantages posed by this scalar vision. The first one is, well, because it's not at odds with the Aristotelian account of substance, in fact, it supplements and enhances it, we see that matter and form, as principles of nature, also exist, so to speak, on a continuum. That matter and form operate in different substances differently, according to where they fall in the scale of esse. The principles of nature that we've discussed need to be understood with respect to a particular tier. What form means in a statue is different from what form means in a living thing or in an angel. In Aquinas' system, there's an analogical flexibility of these concepts. It's not just something to be tolerated, to say, oh, well, that's analogical, as though it's some kind of excuse. No, rather, it's something that should be expected, an evidence of the integrity of a whole system. And if we wanted to take a few examples of matter and form, building up from the bottom, we can take, for example, a syllable as the most basic, even more basic than the statue, the bronze statue, the syllable ba, which is neither mere b nor mere a, right? But the two together, it has some kind of form that surpasses just the material constituents. Then we give our classic example of the statue, acknowledging that form isn't really mere shape, but knowing we need to imagine as we get off the ground in our images. And then to think about form as soul in plants, the way it operates. I shared with you the image of Rodin being inspired to sculpt with the form emerging out from within as a unitive energy that drives forward. But then thinking of animal souls, or what are in scholastic language called material souls, not because they are material, but because they're so bound with matter that they can't exist from it. Then we need the special case of the human person with a subsistent soul. Then considering angels, as I said, along the same spectrum, not with matter proper, but with composition of essence and esse. So without a proper scalar vision, we risk simply having a list of what we deem as better and worse examples. Forms that communicate more unity than others, forms that seem separable from their matter for strange reasons, the human soul, don't really have a place. They seem to be just a mere exception. And it's perhaps this anthropological point that's the most important. If we want to avoid the accusation of being inconsistent in our teaching, you know, we can imagine our objectors say, just this is maybe stretching the imagination, but bear with me. Our objector says, you, Thomas, claim to be Aristotelian. You say that matter and form are inseparable principles that cannot exist without one another. They make a perfect unity. And you say the soul is the form of the body. And then you say that it subsists after death. This must mean that the soul is not really the form of the body. So you have a whole system that consistently accounts for the whole universe, and you make an exception just for human beings. You are hylomorphic hypocrites. You make an exception only for your own human selves. So we can respond to such an objection with Aquinas' scalar vision. Because according to this vision, the human soul is not an exception to hylomorphism, but its best example, in a way. He says, perhaps. The most unified instance of form and matter. And this is from the Summa Contra Gentiles, in a chapter devoted just to this topic, book 2, chapter 68. The intellectual soul is said to be on the horizon and confines of things corporeal and incorporeal. In that, it is an incorporeal substance and yet the form of a body. Nor is a thing composed of an intellectual substance and corporeal matter less one, meaning less united, than a thing made up of the form of fire and its matter. But perhaps it is more, because the greater the mastery of form over matter, the greater is the unity of that which is made from it and matter. So actually, the unity in the human composite is greater because it has a form of, let's say, a higher unitive power. Just because the soul survives death, subsists after death, after the dissolution of the composite with the body, doesn't mean that there's anything lacking in the unity when we are in the body. So that's the first broad conclusion, is that we can give a more appealing account of matter and form if we arrange our examples along a scale such that we expect differences, we expect a gradient. Now, my second conclusion is that the scalar vision presented by Aquinas preserves some of our human intuitions about the harmony of the natural world and created order. I mentioned at the beginning of my first talk that when we say the word nature, we tend to have this in mind, this kind of ensemble of the whole. When the Greeks said cosmos, for example, not phusis, when they said cosmos, they had a similar notion. We even have plenty of cognates that connect that to beauty and the beauty of the whole. Aquinas' scalar vision shows that substances and natures can be placed on a grand continuum that manifests harmony. Now, this harmony further manifests that there is a single creator. Now, let me mention some of the dangers of the Platonic ideas, not just the Platonic, but other ancient philosophical ideas that emphasize the unity of creation a bit too much, the unity of reality a bit too much. Why, for example, do scalar structures of the Platonists make at least some Christians, and in 9th century Baghdad, at least some Muslims, nervous? It can be helpful to think about this aspect, these different pagan pitfalls. For example, the Stoics thought of the universe as one big living being with pneuma, or the fire that permeates the whole. So in a way, the universe is one and the same with the divine principle at work in it. And they would name some of these same points of continuity between higher and lower. Further, we know that one of the big bugaboos of late antiquity and the Middle Ages is the notion that the pagan philosophers thought of the universe as eternal, or that it was, coercively emanated from the first principle, who didn't freely choose, but necessarily gives forth the creation. Then I've already mentioned some of the problems associated with the notion of mediated creation. It would be wrong to be dismissive of harmony and continuity in the cosmos simply out of fear of these errors. Emphasizing the continuity and harmony of the visible world might seem to lead one into these errors, but in fact it doesn't, understood properly, and I think with the safeguard, so to speak, of Aquinas' metaphysics. Let me get a little bit more specific. If Aquinas believes that species exist in a kind of graded continuum, a scale within each genus and then a scale among the genera, this means that some higher species are closer to the next genus. So thinking back to those stairs, you could imagine a higher species of a lower genus anticipating, touching upon the lower species of the next higher genus. Now it's a mouthful when we say it that way, but think about some of the blurry lines we observe between the plant and animal world. Think of the Venus flytrap, right? That in a way it moves in response to a stimuli, unlike other plants, or the pitcher plant. We can also give examples of kind of evidence of quote unquote animal intelligence, or at least the use of a kind of particular reason, the estimative sense, Aristotle and Aquinas would call it. Birds make nests, right? Sheep flee wolves without ever having a good definition, a good working definition of what a wolf is. And nonetheless, they reliably flee from wolves. Even human rationality, especially with regard to intellectus, the intuition of first principles, manifests a kind of quasi-angelic way of knowing. So there's blurry lines at times, but that's okay. And in fact, this further manifests that, well, all of creation proceeds from one creator. There's a lot of evidence for this going back, I think really the oldest systematic account of this is going to be back in the Stoics. And it moves forward with some of the late antique pagan philosophers and Christians who are integrating these notions. One I would like to highlight in particular is Nemesius. So just saying a word about his context. When Dionysius drew upon his sources, one in his library was the Cappadocian Fathers, but also someone by the name of Nemesius, who was a bishop of Emesa in Turkey, and had his own kind of eclectic mix of Stoic and Platonic ideas with Christian revelation. And his On the Nature of Man, De Natura Hominis, is one of the early examples of this kind of synthesis of these ideas. So what, on the one hand, might seem to be a dangerous pagan idea, he's actually turning into yet more proof for the creator, so to speak. So in the opening chapter of his On the Nature of Man, which Aquinas read and cited in different ways, thinking it to be Gregory of Nyssa, we should say, in the opening chapter, Nemesius says, the creator, demiurgos is his word, translated by the medieval translator as conditor. So the creator appears to link together different natures by small differences. so that the whole creation is one and akin, by which it is particularly evident that the creator of all things is one. For he not only unified the existence of each individual thing, composition, of essence and esse, but he also linked them together with each other fittingly. Familiariter in the Latin translation, oikeos in the Greek, which evokes the Stoic tradition of Stoic cosmopolitanism, which has nothing to do with living in a city so much as thinking the world is arranged as a pleasant, harmonious whole. So here, actually, in this very early source, relatively speaking, from someone that's after Iamblichus but before Proclus, really, so the early 400s, this bishop, is writing these ideas. And some of these are received by Dionysius and then also directly by Aquinas and the others in the Middle Ages. So the gradient that there are many shades of being, thus the gradient, the many shades of being, are so because higher beings have been placed, so to speak, next to lower by the creator himself. It's not the sign that the higher beings have made the lower beings. So it's evidence of a single giver of being, a single giver of essence. So God is not only the maker of matter, but the giver of forms, the author of essences, and the supplier of esse. So there, another image I want to give you that Aquinas takes up from Dionysius is the notion of circumlocution, which if you've ever tried to learn a foreign language, you realize is an important skill. When you don't know that one word, you've got to figure out how to say it in sometimes many other words. And actually, this is an analogy Dionysius uses to describe God's problem in creation, desiring to express his perfect unity and perfection, he has to resort to many examples. So that's an explanation for the diversity of creation, the grand diversity of creation, manifesting the perfect transcendent simplicity of the creator. There's no perfect word to say himself, you know, to express himself. And so creation is, in a way, God's poetry and self-description. We can also consider things relative to the creator, who is the giver of perfections, and relative to their neighbors. We can compare animals of greater or lesser perfection on the scale, and it manifests something about the single creator. I can go more into that idea, but I want to press on, showing that actually what we're given in Aquinas' vision is a true emergent synthesis of sources. And we can return to that image so often cited, so often reproduced, of the School of Athens in Julius II's library in the Raphael Rooms of the Vatican Museum, where you have Plato and Aristotle. And I don't know, it seems like until maybe just about a year ago, I'd always thought of them as contrasted. And I feel like I'd been given that explanation again. Oh, you see, you have Plato insisting that reality's up there, and Aristotle saying, no, it's here, it's down here. And it's just obvious that it's not a competitive vision, that in fact what's being portrayed is a synthesis of all these figures and the wisdom together. And it's, if you look closely, you see it's, what is Plato holding? The Timaeus, pointing up to the demiurge in the vault. What is Aristotle holding? The ethics, as a necessary kind of starting point for a philosophical life. I would want to also add the metaphysics into his book, you know. But we know that Raphael was influenced by some of the Renaissance Neoplatonists up in Florence. Okay, just an aside, it's useful to think of that as an image to come back to. We know that philosophy begins in poetry. Well, let's hope it's fortunate enough to end so. I began with Hopkins, and I'd like to conclude with Dante in Paradiso, a fitting Easter note for our Ascension Day conference. As Dante ascends, he acquires not only deeper knowledge of salvation, but of creation. And these are revealed, co-revealed in tandem as he ascends. As Beatrice explains to him the great reason for Christ's atonement when he asks, why was it necessary that the Christ should suffer in such a way? She explains that the restorative power of the resurrection flows from the same source as the nature's, the one who gives nature, the one who gives elements and forms. We see in this text, specifically Canto 7 of the Paradiso, God is described as the giver of matter and the elements, but also the cause of causality and the former of formative influence and the direct giver of the soul. So I'll just read you a few tercets to conclude. The elements you name were all informed by a created power, a second cause. They and all other things they constitute. Created was the matter they possess. Created was the forming influence, raining upon them from these circling stars. The souls of the brute animals and plants are drawn by the revolving of these fires out of the potency of elements. But the peak of beneficence inspires your life without a means, your living soul, and so enamoring it that it desires its maker ever. And if you recall how God first formed man's flesh in paradise, when he made both our parents, you shall see that after death, your bodies shall arise. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.